Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before European settlers transformed the north reach of the Willamette River near its confluence with the Columbia, it was a braided river of shallow channels and islands rich in biodiversity. Today, the area is designated an industrial sanctuary, but the communities that were displaced or damaged by this so-called sanctuary see it as an industrial sacrifice zone. Today we talk with Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for Portland Audubon, and Mamalang Memela, who is with the Braided River Campaign and the Portland Harbor Community Coalition, about a campaign underway to transform the sacrifice zone created by the Portland Harbor into a green working waterfront defined by good jobs, clean energy, and healthy ecosystems. Bob and Mamalang, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having us today.
Thank you for having us, Barbara.
Well, Bob, you and I have talked a lot over the last few years about issues around the Port of Portland and the Portland Harbor and the contradiction between Portland being a super green city in its own mind and the way that the land along the north reach of the Willamette River has been treated. So I just wanted to start, before we get into the main gist of what we're going to be talking about today, about this whole concept of there being this industrial sanctuary that provides enough land for the Port of Portland and other industrial users to have access to industrial land on the river. And what are some of the concerns you have about that?
Well, the Willamette River at the confluence with the Columbia is an incredibly important place to our community, to our environment. And really, for more than a century, the city has treated it as a sacrifice zone, as a place for industry without consideration for the health of our environment, the health of our communities. We do need places for industry to go, and the North Reach may be an appropriate place for that, but we need to think more broadly and think about all the different factors that are important to our community and how we treat our river. And so we need a broader perspective as we move forward, because we've done incredible harm to our environment. And we've done harm to our communities as well. How do we develop a vision that's more holistic, greener, healthier, more equitable going forward?
Well, one of the things that's curious to me is what role the city has played in allowing this kind of pollution to happen along the river. Is the city responsible, or who? What entity is responsible for allowing the kind of degradation that's happened?
The North Reach of the Willamette, and I'm thinking here of the area that stretches really from around the Fremont Bridge, a little bit south of the Fremont Bridge, all the way to the confluence, so about an 11-mile stretch of river, has been used by industry really for the better part of a century. This has been an area where the port has been located, where shipbuilding and ship breaking and ship repair has been done. Imports and exports, a variety of industrial activities have been located in this area of the city. And that has resulted in incredible habitat degradation and pollution. There's an 11-mile stretch of the Willamette River that is a federal Superfund site, which is the designation that we give to the most contaminated high-risk sites in the country. This one is one of the largest and most complicated. And over 150 different businesses contributed to that pollution over time. So we have a very long history of really treating our river poorly. Also, for a very long time, we had combined sewer overflows, which went into the river. So when we had big rain event, our sewage would go directly into the river as well. So we were literally using our river as a toilet. So there are a lot of different problems associated with the way we treated our river. And unfortunately, while we are making some progress, the combined sewer overflows were addressed through the big pipe a decade ago. The city has been working with the state and the federal agencies to clean up the Superfund area. There's been progress on habitat. We still have structural impediments to really creating a holistic green vision for our river.
And what are these structural impediments?
The biggest challenge we have is something called Goal 9. We have statewide land use planning goals that every municipality has to adhere to. And statewide land use planning Goal 9 basically is the industrial land goal. It requires municipalities to maintain a 20-year supply of industrial land. And the way in which cities determine whether they have a supply of industrial land, an adequate supply for 20 years, is a process called the Economic Opportunities Analysis, or EOA. And this is a process that is usually done mainly with businesses and their consultants and the city at the table. But the public has a very small role. In fact, most of the public never even knows this is going on. But the outcome of that process is what determines how we develop land around the river and in other industrial zones as well. Because if the city finds that it has inadequate industrial land, it has to find a way to basically supplement the existing land base. And industry has used an argument that we have a lack of industrial land as a way to essentially fight new environmental regulations, environmental protections, other land uses on the river now for several decades, and also to argue that open space should be converted to industrial use in order to make up for this deficit.
Why is it that there's so little input into how these decisions are made from people who are being directly impacted, who live close to the areas where this where the industry is centered?
It's a very strange process. Basically, what the city does is it develops an industrial land forecast, and they hire consultants, and they go behind closed doors with industry and interview industry and collect a variety of data. And eventually what happens is the city spits out a report that says we either have or we don't have enough industrial land for the next 20 years. The main inputs into this process are from industry itself. So it's from the organizations that benefit from protecting industrial land. And what has emerged from this process, which is done about every 5 years, it's updated about every 5 years, is that the city doesn't have enough industrial land. And it needs to go find more. The public doesn't pay a lot of attention to this, and the city doesn't do much in the way of engaging the general public because it's one of those processes that's confusing, it's esoteric, and for the most part, the impacts are not felt immediately. You know, it doesn't result in immediate conversion of industrial lands. It doesn't result in immediate removal of regulations. Those things happen down the road over time. And so oftentimes the public doesn't even understand why decisions are being made. And the basis for those decisions are this EOA, this economic opportunities analysis that happened several years earlier.
Well, Mylong, you've been working with a group called the Brady River Campaign, a relatively new organization that's addressing some of the disconnect between the communities that live close to the industrial sacrifice zone along the river and their ability to have any impact. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the work that your organization's doing and why you even formed in the first place.
Yes, so I do work with the Braided River Campaign. I also work with the Portland Harbor Community Coalition, but I came through the Braided River Campaign with a different organization. But basically what we're trying to do within the Braided River Campaign is to illuminate the history of the Portland Harbor. People have been displaced in North Portland from the area. There's an area called Galds Lake Industrial Sanctuary, very close to Montgomery Park. And there used to be people living there a long time ago. And over the years, the city of Portland has enacted different policies that have displaced people. And so now we find ourselves in a situation where their processes, such as the EOA and the comprehensive plan that are being discussed and that have different levels of community engagement. But it's kind of difficult, especially now with the fact that that area is heavily industrialized and there aren't that many people living there as a result of the fact that that area has been made a sacrificial zone.
Well, one of the things that struck me as I've been hanging out with Zoom meetings with the Braided River Campaign as well is learning about how little is known about the history of this region. And I wonder if you can address that problem. And is that something you're trying to bring to your meetings with the city now?
Yes. So one of the founding members of the Braided River Campaign is Sarah Taylor. And she's also a folk historian and lives in Linton and is very knowledgeable about the area and North Portland in general. And some of the things that we've learned through conversations with her and the research that we've done within the coalition is the fact that the Portland Harbor was never suitable for a deep water seaport. And it's just kind of like it's been a shallow river with a system of wetlands, streams, and lakes. I was very surprised to find out the fact that in that area close to Montgomery Park, which used to be Gulls Lake, besides the fact that it's sitting on a liquefaction zone and there are fossil fuel tanks over there, and that comes with its own danger as Portland is due for an earthquake pretty soon, is the fact that people used to live there and farm, and there were many communities. It was a very, very diverse place. Obviously, at the time, thinking about like the 1920s and the 1930s in Portland, but people were like brought there primarily to work along the river and to live along the river.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about that area, it really hit me very hard when I first moved to Portland almost 50 years ago, is like you're going north on Highway 30, and on your left is Forest Park, and it's this beautiful forested area. And then there's a little bit of industry to your left as you're heading out of town. On the right, it was this weird industrial wasteland that was very disconcerting to me at first. Like, and it separated. I could see the separation between the community and a little bit of Linton that was still left and the river. And at first it shocked me, and after a while I just took it for granted. And I wonder if that's one of the problems that we have, is that people just take this for granted. This is the way it is, and this is the way it's supposed to be.
What's exciting right now, I think, is for a long time, the community did accept this area as a sacrifice zone. I've been working on river issues for about 30 years. Portland Audubon has prioritized that because this is such an important place ecologically and also for our community's health. And it's been treated so badly. You know, from a salmon perspective, for example, every single salmon that uses the 187-mile-long Willamette River system has to pass through Portland Harbor. And what we were seeing was that things were going the wrong direction, that more and more land was being consumed for industry, that the conditions were getting worse in terms of environmental and community health, and that places like West Haden Island, for example, were being under attack. Huge natural area that back in the 1990s, up until recently, the port had wanted to convert into industrial facilities. And what we saw was that it didn't really make any sense, that that a lot of the drivers that were propelling things forward did not allow for community engagement, that the community was detached from these processes and from the river itself. So it's been a long haul to get to a point where I think the community is now demanding to be more involved. And I think groups like the Braided River Coalition, the Portland Harbor Community Coalition, the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group have done an amazing job of mobilizing people and getting them involved and making them realize that this is their river, this is our river, and that we should have a say in how it moves forward.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Bob Salinger, who's the Conservation Director for Portland Audubon, and Mama Lang Memela, who's with the Braided River Campaign and the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. And we're talking about a campaign underway to transform the industrial sacrifice zone created by the Portland Harbor into a green working waterfront defined by good jobs, clean energy, and healthy ecosystems. So the question is how we get there. And you guys have been involved in conversations with the city now for several months. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some recent meetings that have happened between the Braided River Campaign and members of the Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. Mama Lang, I'm curious about your response to what's happened at those meetings, what you went into those meetings expecting, and what has happened in the several months since you've been meeting with the city.
I kind of joined the Braided River Campaign a bit later than a lot of other people, but as I entered those meetings, I wasn't really sure what to expect. I know that from doing research about how cities work and how they may work with different other like local agencies and how they may work with different community groups, that they are set in like their own ways, and that they may not be as flexible. But I think last year we felt a sense of optimism, especially during the protests during the summer, and people were calling for change, and we wanted to use that momentum and think within like the intersections of all the issues that came up during that period, and use that momentum and that energy in in interfacing with the city of Portland. During those meetings, we've been speaking to the city about just the economic opportunities analysis and different aspects of it, and trying to offer as much community feedback and input into the process, and just trying to present what our vision would be for that. And as Bob kind of mentioned earlier, we want natural resource conservation, we want to think about salmon habitats, we want to think about community health and access to the river and benefits, even within like the Superfund site. And like the framework of that, we want all of this to be connected and the river not to just be thought of as separate areas, which is what has been happening in like the last couple of years. We also want a green working waterfront and sustainable industry, as we're thinking about climate change and the governor's executive order, and also the ordinance in Portland that doesn't want, where we don't want any new fossil fuel infrastructure, and just thinking about a just cleanup and a just transition as we move forward.
Well, Bob, there was a meeting, I think it was last month, where the company that had done the initial study that the city was waiting for gave their presentation. And I wanted to get your response to that presentation. What did anything surprise you, or were you basically feeling like this was just deja vu from your 30 years of trying to work on these issues?
It was deja vu. It was business as usual. It was very disappointing, and it failed to meet the city's commitment to be more inclusive, to be more transparent, and to address environmental justice issues from the start of processes, not as something that they tack on at the end, not as a bell and a whistle, but as something that is foundational to the processes that the city provides for public input. Unfortunately, what the city did was what it's done in the past, which is it hired a consultant, the consultant interviewed business interests, and then produced a report based on the input of those business interests, called a marine industrial land analysis, that will provide the foundation for the city's assessment of whether it has enough industrial land. And despite the fact that the Braided River Coalition and others had spent months and months talking to the city about doing this process differently, about being more inclusive, about it including community groups, frontline organizations, environmental groups, neighborhood associations, despite the fact that we had repeatedly telegraphed to them that this was important and that they seem to have heard that, the way they've moved forward, unfortunately, is exactly the way they've done it previously.
Well, what are some of your concerns about them coming, having this be the first study that they release?
It sets the foundation for the whole process. And what that means is that what you have now going out to the media, to decision makers, to public engagement forums, is a foundation that basically represents the interests of big industry. And now it is up to the public and stakeholder groups to push back on that and to try and get it fixed, and to try and take out the most disappointing parts. But even if we're successful doing that, that won't be enough, because the questions they asked in the first place are the wrong questions. So we're fixing a document that is fundamentally problematic. They, for example, don't look at climate change. They don't look at habitat. They don't look at access to the river. They don't look at different sectors and whether they're actually producing the jobs that they're supposed to produce. They don't look at environmental impacts of the industries that are there. It's a very, very narrow, narrow document that basically tells us whether there is enough industrial land and what the demand is going to be going forward. And what we need is a process that asks the right questions, engages broadly from the beginning, so that we can start to shape a different vision. If the process is the same process that we've used in the past, the vision won't change either. I want to spend a second just talking about why should our community even care about something called an economic opportunities analysis? Why is there a Braided River Coalition, this coalition of groups that has formed? And the reason is this relatively esoteric document that most people have never heard of is what drives land use on our river. And every 5 years, the city reproduces this document, basically behind closed doors with industrial landowners who have a vested interest in its outcome. And every 5 years, the city reaches the same conclusions, which are we don't have enough industrial land, especially along the river, along the Willamette and Columbia in Portland. Once the city reaches that conclusion, under statewide land use planning goal 9, they have to find that land. That's a requirement under goal 9. And because the city reaches this conclusion that they don't have enough industrial land, industry is then able to use that as leverage to get a lot of things that they want. What kinds of things do they want? Well, one is they want more industrial land. So we've had industry demanding golf courses, natural areas, West Hayden Island, a variety of other sites be converted to industrial land. Who wins and who loses when that happens? Well, the public loses and industry wins. They get more cheap land to develop. How else have they used it? Every time the city has tried to put environmental regulations on our river to improve the health and ecology of our river, industry has fought back and said, no, that will reduce our industrial land supply. You can't do that. If you do it, we'll appeal to the state and you'll lose. And in fact, they have done that. And because the city has acknowledged there's a lack of industrial land, they have lost. That's why we don't protect trees on industrial land, for example. Our tree code does not imply on river industrial land. How else have they used it? They've used it to keep other community uses that are really important, like access and environmental restoration, out of this area of the river. And finally, they've gamed the system. Part of the reason that we may not have as much industrial land as we need is because industry has gone to the city over and over again and ask the city to upzone industrial land. We have industrial landowners going to the city and saying, hey, we want to upzone Terminal 1 for high-priced condominiums. We want to upzone Terminal 2 for a baseball stadium. We want to put a mall out by the airport on industrial land. And the reason they want to do that is because they're cashing out. That land is a lot more valuable as commercial or residential. But those exact same interests that go to the city and ask to have industrial land upzoned, then turn around and come back and say, we don't have enough industrial land, you need to give us more, and you can't protect the environment, and you can't have other uses on our lands. So it's really been the paradigm that has kept the status quo in place now for a very, very long time. And I think this economic opportunities analysis is the opportunity to take a different approach. And it's not that I think we want industrial land eliminated along the river. Those industries are important, those jobs are important, but we need a more holistic vision that protects the environment, allows other uses where appropriate, restores our river, and also holds industry accountable, because the reason we have Goal 9 is about jobs. And the other piece of this puzzle that has been a great fallacy has been that industry claims they need more industrial land in order to provide jobs. But in fact, despite the fact that our industrial land base is increasing and our cargo throughputs have been increasing for most of the last several decades, jobs have actually been going down. So while industry claims they're doing this in the names of jobs, they're really doing what they're doing in the name of profits.
What was the response that you got from the city? Because I remember in that meeting, you brought these issues up. Do you think that they're listening at all?
I think they are listening. I think some things are changing that are exciting. First of all, I think coalitions like the Braided River Coalition are just incredible to see. You know, the fact that the public is getting involved, that all these groups are forming coalitions and getting involved and saying, we demand that you do business differently. We insist that this be a different kind of process, more open, more transparent, more inclusive, more holistic. So I think the work that Mamaling is doing and others is just incredibly important. Number two, I think we're seeing a change. We're seeing some fracture lines where industry used to be pretty monolithic along the river in terms of advocating for more industrial land. All the industrial interests were advocating for industrial land. We're starting to see some folks break ranks. And the big one is the Port of Portland. The Port of Portland for decades has insisted that they needed more river industrial land for marine terminals. But over the last couple of years, they've had new leadership, new analysis, and we give them a ton of credit for this. And they've acknowledged that, in fact, they don't even need all the industrial land they have. That is really a groundbreaking development, because to have an industrial landowner of the size of the Port of Portland say that, in fact, they have reassessed what they've been saying for decades and now recognize that not only do they not need more industrial land, they don't need places like West Haden Island that they have previously argued should be converted to industrial use. They're now saying we don't even need the land we have. And so they're looking for other uses for Terminal 2 and for some other sites. Curtis Robinhold announced in the Oregonian a couple of weeks ago that they have this prosperity initiative where they want to be more inclusive and that they're looking at their surplus lands and how they can best serve the community, particularly through an equity lens. And I give the Port of Portland a ton of credit for that transformation. I think it's incredibly important, incredibly powerful, and it's a game changer. And so my hope is that this combination of coalitions, of groups coming together and really saying to the city, we want you to be more inclusive and transparent and equitable, and organizations like the Port of Portland saying we've rethought what we've been saying for a long time, will result in a very, very different process where we can really think about what the highest and best use for river industrial land is, what other uses need to be integrated, how we create climate resiliency, how we make sure that whatever goes there supports the health of workers and the communities that surround the industrial area. And that we have ecological uplift, that this incredibly important ecological place at the confluence of the Willamette and the Columbia is restored to ecological health. And we can get there. It is possible to do that, but it's only going to be possible if the city changes the way it does business in the first place. And that's the question mark. That's what we're still waiting to see.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for Portland Audubon, and Mamaling Memela, who's with the Braided River Campaign and the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. And we're talking about ways to re-envision what has become an industrial sacrifice zone and see some way to turn it into a green working waterfront. Mamela, I'm curious what you think about this disconnect. Bob was sort of alluding to this, between what is happening in many parts of the city, including the Port of Portland, and what the Planning Commission still seems to be seeing as their mission. And going back to this meeting last month that we were at, I found it interesting that just before that meeting happened, there was this article that Bob was referring to in the Oregonian where the port's talking about sharing the prosperity, but basically recognizing that they have to look at a new direction for the way that the whole Portland Harbor area and their industrial properties is managed. And it seemed like the city didn't know anything about it. So I just wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Yes, Barbara, it's like very true that we have been seeing, so the port did come out with the Shared Prosperity Initiative, and we had a conversation with some representatives from the port about that, and they couldn't really give us a lot of information about what that entails, just that this is what they plan on doing and plan on exploring, and they'll be reaching out to different community groups to get that together and make sure that that's rolled out, and trying to see how they can better make sure that they interface and do outreach with specific communities. One thing that we've seen in during this period, as we have been having this conversation, is the fact that what Bob was talking about, the paradigm hasn't shifted, and that's one thing that we're trying to push through the Braided River campaign. But there is definitely a disconnect between what's happening at the state level and the local level. We've also spoken to people from Prosper Portland, and it seems like there are a lot of quasi-government adjacent agencies that are working on different things, and also the port and the city, but they're not all coming together to talk about what the goals are and like what are the implications of the governor signing an executive order that's declaring climate change an emergency, and like what, how does the fossil fuel ordinance impact industry and impact the city and planning. And so it's been very interesting to have conversations with the people in the city, and see there is this disconnect between what is happening at, in different places and at different levels, but also we're not seeing that change trickle down to something as simple as like the economic opportunities analysis and like the marine industrial land analysis.
I want to go off into a little corner for a moment about Prosper Portland, which used to have a different name and has a really gnarly history. I want to talk a little bit about who is Prosper Portland really and what do they have to confront, I think, in order to move ahead and be really part of a much more diverse and equitable future for the city of Portland.
Prosper Portland was the Portland Development Commission, and the Portland Development Commission has a long history of urban renewal districts and other development initiatives that resulted in a lot of displacement and that we have a legacy of today. I give the city some credit here, PDC, for trying to remake itself, but that is a, you know, difficult and slow process. But I do think it's an agency that is starting to think differently about its mission and who it should serve. And I think the city is thinking differently about that as well. I mean, I think these are big transitions and they take time. And that's not an excuse. That's a reason to put additional pressure on them. And so, you know, I think something like the economic opportunities analysis is kind of the epitome of the way we used to do business. You know, this document that only big, powerful interests were involved in developing, that then guides an entire area of our city for years and years to come. I mean, that's what the ELA is. It's basically this document that's done behind closed doors with big, powerful industrial interests and their consultants and nobody else, really. And then it spits out a result that serves those same exact powerful interests and keeps everyone else out. And when the public comes in 2 or 3 years later and wants to know why they can't have a green space or access to the river or plant trees in this area, they're told, well, there was this process and we've already cross that bridge and it's too late. And so, you know, this document epitomizes exactly how we shouldn't be doing things. And I think the city is having challenges understanding that this is exactly the kind of thing that they need to be looking at when they talk about being more inclusive, being more equitable, and doing things differently and doing them from the ground up differently. I think that's what the disconnect is that we're having right now, is that they're talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. And what we ask for is a do-over. Basically, we have been having some good dialogue with the city, but they got off on the wrong foot nonetheless. And we want them to go back. There's going to be more reports to come. This is just the first of many, but we want them to do it right from the get-go. We want them to start out on the right foot and build a different foundation of inclusivity. And so we're asking them to go back, have their consultants do a much broader interview process, bring in a much wider range of issues. I think we all understand that some of the issues that people will raise are not going to be germane to the process. They can filter some of those. But I think if they do it differently, they'll ask different questions, they'll get different answers, and we'll have different outcomes. And so that's the request that's on the table. They're just a few steps into this process. Go back and do it right, and let's do it in a way that really does bring in more voices, and especially voices that have been disenfranchised.
The Planning Commission's reason for why they did this particular study first was they had funding from the state to do it, and so they did it. And it seemed like it's a strange way, in my mind, to operate, that you just go, you just follow the money, basically. Whoever's funding you is who's going to become basically the startup for this project. I wonder how you How do you deal with that kind of mentality? How do you get them to go beyond thinking in terms of running after each grant?
This is where we really need to hold institutions accountable, because this is where the structural elements come in. We just heard the same thing last week from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and City of Portland on another project, too. Well, this is where the funding took us. My answer is, then don't accept that funding. Turn the funding down. If the funding is going to build in structural racism, disenfranchisement, disinclusion, environmental degradation, climate denial, all of those things, then that's the wrong funding source for you to take. And you've got to go back and raise a different source of funding. Or you need to go back to the state and say, state, this funding source doesn't meet our needs. This funding source represents the way we thought 25 years ago, but not the way we think today. And we're either not going to accept your funding, or more to the point, we would like you to change the criteria so we can be inclusive, equitable, and do things differently. But I think too often we see municipalities using exactly that excuse that, well, this is the funding source we had, so this is the way we're doing it. If that's the excuse, then we're never going to change.
So how do you think you get the city to actually listen? I mean, I feel like there's some hope, and you're expressing a lot more hope than I've heard from you probably over the last 20 years or so. But how do you see that the city could actually change, and what kind of leverage points do you feel you have to make that change happen?
I think the only thing that ever really causes change is people. People standing up and insisting that things be done differently. Honestly, I've always had hope. Part of the reason I've stuck with this is I've seen progress over the last 30 years. We've had tremendous progress. We have a much cleaner river. Superfund is advancing. West Hayden Island has not been developed. Combined sewer overflows have been reduced by more than 90%. We've made tremendous progress because people have stood up and insisted that things be different. But I think what gives me a lot more hope today is organizations like the Braided River Coalition, which are really bringing together a far broader group of voices. That's where the power is ultimately, is in bringing all these people, organizations that have a vested interest, that have been impacted today and historically, and bringing them together to insist that things be done differently. And remember, we're standing up against the most powerful businesses, not only in the state, but in the world. You know, we have the big oil companies in the North Reach. We have huge national corporations. We have the biggest organizations in Oregon. These are incredibly powerful, entrenched, well-connected organizations. And so the only way to push back is to bring together a lot of voices in a unified way. And say that this is not acceptable. And I think we right now have a city council that is much more focused on inclusion and equity and environmental justice. I'd like to believe that they're sincere about that. And I think it's our job to point out where they're not achieving that vision. So I guess that's what gives me hope, is that, you know, I'm not surprised there are missteps. That's to be expected. The change is hard. But it's our job to point it out and ask them to go back and try and do it better, and not to give them a free pass.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBRU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFTL PFM and KODXL PFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for Portland Audubon, and Mamelang Memela, who is with the Braided River Campaign and the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. And we're talking about how to process is going to take to transform what is now a sacrifice zone along the north reach of the Willamette River into a green working waterfront. Mamelang, I'm wondering what you see the upcoming work on the part of the Braided River Campaign to push the agenda that Bob was just talking about.
Right now within the Braided River Campaign, we're pretty focused on bringing more awareness to the issues that we're facing, mainly through outreach and education. And we have recently just finished working on some portraits that we got some local artists to paint to kind of depict the different people who historically lived near and close to the river, just to illuminate the past so that we can learn from the past and chart how we got to where we are to be able to make better decisions for the future. And we are working toward having an Earth Day launch and working on having a big event for that to get more community members involved. I think two important things that Bob highlighted were that people are where the power lies, and the more people who are involved and the more people who are aware and the more people who can engage in different actions that we have and like put pressure on city council and the city, the more likely we will be to see change happen. And also it's very important to know that this is a long haul issue. This is not something that we're going to be able to fix in the space of like a few weeks or a few days or a few months. This is something that we're going to have to be putting pressure on for years to come. And I think it's very important for also young people to realize that we may be energetic and we may want to push things as well, but we have to know that we're going to be pushing for a long time.
Yes, that's always the case. Bob, you mentioned concern that the economic opportunity assessment is this arcane document that nobody's ever heard of. You brought it to the Brady River campaign is like, this is a must do. We have to deal with this right now. Do you feel like you are making headway in getting this, what was once a very arcane document, into the public awareness?
I think the Brady River campaign is making headway on doing that. So credit to the Brady River campaign for that. And because, you know, a lot of the questions that we got over the years were, why isn't the requirement to plant trees in the industrial area? Why don't we have better river regulations? Why did this process fail where we were all involved? Why is this golf course, Broadmoor Golf Course, being the front part of it being converted to industrial area and all the big trees being cut down? And the answer has its origins in this arcane document that was produced 5 years earlier. And the answer, very simply, is that industry was successful in convincing the city that we had a deficit of industrial land. And under Goal 9, they have to fill that deficit. They're required under state law to do that. And so the city has gone on this frantic search to find more industrial land to fill this alleged deficit. And so many decisions have been driven by this arcane document. But again, you know, when the document's produced, it's done with just really industry in the room for the most part. In 2015, there were some other stakeholder groups we were invited in, and we did make some headway. But for the most part, it's really off the public's radar screen. And, I think people are starting to understand that if we really want to make change on the river, this is where it's going to begin. And it is going to be a long process, you know. If we have a successful outcome of this industrial lands analysis, this EOA, that will basically, in my mind, determine that we have more industrial land than we actually need, that there's more flexibility on the river than we thought that we had. It'll be more specific about the type of industrial lands that we want to actually have and what kinds of businesses we want there. And what kind of conditions we want for the people who work in the industrial area, as well for the environment and the surrounding communities. So it'll be a much more holistic document, but there's going to be a series of processes that will build off of this in the future that will ultimately bring that vision to fruition. So it's not a one-off. It's a many, many year-long process. But this is where the foundation is laid, so it's really important that we get this part right, because everything else will follow.
Well, what should follow? Let's talk in the last few minutes we have here about what your vision is of what is a green working waterfront.
A green working waterfront has housing for people and also like low income housing, just because the rent in Portland is very expensive. We want transportation and for people to be able to get there and get away from there, either for work or for play. And we want people to have access to the river. There aren't that many places along the Willamette in Portland that people can go and hang out. There are very few and limited spaces. And so we want more river access for people. And we just want fresher air and places to walk and take healthy breaks for workers who would be working there. We want good union jobs for people to protect workers and their wages and to protect their health as well.
Well, another concern, I mean, there is a kind of heavy emphasis in the Portland Harbor on fossil fuel and on a very polluting, dirty industry. What do you see, Bob, as some alternative industries that could get a foothold in the Portland Harbor?
I think there's a variety. I think we need to start to think about what a climate smart economy looks like. And the future of that economy is not fossil fuels, as has already been stated. We have a fossil fuel hub on a earthquake liquefaction zone. So it's incredibly dangerous to the community and the environment. And I think what we really need to be exploring in this economic opportunities analysis is what kind of jobs do we want in 5, 10, 50, 100 years in this location? Not what do we have today, but what do we want in the future? I think that's one of the foundational questions that we need to be asking as part of the economic opportunities analysis. Because the way it's done right now, it just perpetuates the status quo. Here's what we have, and here's what we think is coming. And it's a very passive document in that sense. I think one of the foundational questions we need to ask is, what kind of jobs do we want on our river? And what is the future that makes sense for Portland? As was pointed out earlier, we're a deep water port 100 miles up a river, located in what was once such a shallow braided river that you could walk across the river, literally walk across the river at Swan Island. And for some reason, we turned it into a deep water port, but that really is probably not sustainable. And so what is the future of river industry? I think when we start to have those kinds of questions and we couple those with questions like, what else do we need to do on our river in terms of our environment, in terms of access, in terms of equity, in terms of housing, in terms of green infrastructure, in terms of air quality, in terms of climate resiliency, then we're going to start to build a holistic, equitable vision that's based in community rather than the economic interests of some of the biggest corporations in the world.
Well, one last question. Both of you have talked about the fact that the communities that are along the north reach of the Willamette are, except for the expanse of Cathedral Park, they have no access to the river. How do you reconnect the river with the people and with nature for that matter?
One of the first steps is to dismantle the fossil fuel infrastructure and all the other infrastructure that poses risks and also pollutes the area, and replace that with clean energy or conserve those areas and make them community access points or make them places for the salmon to rest as they're going along their journey.
Bob, in terms of getting the river back to some sort of semblance of a natural river, do you have any vision about how that would happen and what that would look like?
I do. We would have bigger setbacks that were protected and restored. Industry does need access to the river, so there do need to be points where river access is provided to industry for sure, but we would have wider setbacks. We would also have habitat nodes. When salmon go to the sea, they need habitat about every quarter mile, and shallow water habitat along the edges of a river, in order to really survive. And that's where they rest, forage, and get away from predators as they go to the sea. Every salmon that uses the Willamette River system goes through Portland Harbor, which has been deepened, hardened. The banks have been stripped of vegetation. And so there really is very little adequate habitat left, virtually none. My vision, I think the vision that we've been promoting has really been one where we do significant restoration there, consistent with still having a working harbor. But, the problem right now is if the economic opportunities analysis comes out the way the past ones have, it'll say that we have a lack of industrial land, that we need more. And if that happens, that will be the only conversation we have. Because under state law, if you have a deficit of industrial land, your first priority is filling it. And if in fact we determine again that we have a deficit of industrial land, despite mountains of evidence to the contrary, then we won't have any of these discussions. We're not going to be talking about things like access to the river, environmental restoration, affordable housing, green infrastructure, because it shuts down all of those things and it gives industry a legal lever that's very easy to pull, that every time somebody comes in and wants to talk about those things, they will say, nope, because we don't have enough industrial land. Why don't we have enough industrial land? Because we went behind closed doors with the city of Portland and determined that we don't have enough industrial land. And So it becomes just a vicious circle, and that's what we're trying to break out of.
Well, one last thing. I'm thinking about how in the old days when we could get together in person, that there'd be city council meetings and people would hang banners from the balcony and take over meetings. It's hard to do that on Zoom. So I'm wondering, in the next few months before we actually start having in-person meetings again, do you see any way to like hang virtual banners from virtual balconies to get this point across that you're trying to make?
Our first stop as a coalition was at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, because they are overseeing this process, and we have met with them many times. And in fact, we have a standing monthly meeting that's very well attended, where we've been trying to work out a different paradigm. I'm still hopeful that we can get this thing back on course and that we can build together. But if that's not possible, then I think the next stop is City Council. And it's hard to hang banners in a Zoom meeting, but I do think it's very possible to meet with city commissioners and start to have a discussion about making sure that we fulfill our commitments around inclusion, equity, and the environment. And I hope we'll get a receptive ear there. And then, of course, you know, you can move up the scale in terms of pressure tactics. And I don't think the community is ready to stand down on its river. I don't think people are willing to just let this go by. I think there is just a really strong and growing consciousness that our river is polluted, degraded, inaccessible, and inequitable, and that that needs to change. And so I think this is a movement that's only going to grow bigger and stronger. So I am hopeful, but you know, we're still in conversations with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, but if we can't get satisfaction there, we'll keep moving up the chain.
Well, Bob and Mamala, thanks so much for joining us on Locus Focus today. And I really appreciate your work, and keep at it.
Thanks for having us, Barbara.
We've been talking with Bob Salinger, Conservation Director for Portland Audubon, and Mamalang Memela, who is with the Braided River Campaign and the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk about the Line 3 oil pipeline with Elijah Cetus with the Braided River Campaign. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with another tune that I wrote. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
Living in a land of rainbows, searching for the rainbow's end. Drenched dreams glisten in the sunlight that flickers only now and then. Sodden streams of sorrow fall like rain. But leaflets strewn in puddles can't explain a moment's grace that fills the air, spreading lightness that can overcome despair. The hopes and dreams and plans we schemed when we were young evaporate as time grows long and life seems short. Sometimes it seems that what we have is all we'll ever get. But what I knew so well when I was young has stayed with me too long to now forget. I see my dreams in windows etched with rain, reflecting what I know but cannot name. As time spreads wide its wings and draws aside, I feel the hope that I'll learn to fly. I'll learn to fly. Etched with rain, reflecting what I know but cannot name. As time spreads wide its wings and draws aside, I feel the hope that I'll learn to fly. I'll learn to fly.